Welcome to the Liver Lounge, your go-to podcast for the latest updates in hepatology, featuring discussions with the world's leading experts.
So thank you everyone for listening in to this latest podcast by the Liver Foundation. I'm Margaret Ting. I'm one of the consultants from National University Health System in Singapore. Have with me today, Professor Pavel Strnad. He's from the University Hospital of Aachen, Germany. And I'm really, really delighted to have him today. He and his team have recently published an article entitled Alpha-1 Antitrypsin Augmentation and the Liver Phenotype of Adults with Alpha-1 Antitrypsin Deficiency with the Genotype of PIZZ. This was published in the Clinical Gastroenterology and Hepatology in 2023. So thanks very much, Professor Pavel, for joining us today to discuss alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency and its effects on the liver. If I may just start the ball rolling by giving some background to this article. And you know, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is not something that is rarely, it's something that's quite rarely discussed. And I think many of our listeners may not know much about this disease. So if you could perhaps shed some light on the clinical manifestations of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency and how does this actually cause liver disease?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. So alpha-1 antitrypsin is actually one of the most abundant proteins that are produced by the liver. So number one is albumin, but alpha-1 antitrypsin is one of the top five. And so this is produced for the liver in the liver to serve the whole body. So it's a protease inhibitor. That means that it protects from tissue degradation. And in a normal, let's say, patient without any mutation, this is produced, rapidly secreted into the bloodstream to fulfill its protective function. In alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, you have a mutation in this gene, and the characteristic mutation is actually the PIZ mutation. It leads to a problem in the folding, and because of that, a problem in the secretion. So, so the vast majority of protein is not secreted and accumulates in the liver, and this accumulation causes what we call gain of function toxic liver disease. So you basically have just a lot of damaged protein, which is making you problems in the liver. And in the remaining part of the body, you have a alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, which is what actually the name says. That means that your serum alpha-1 antitrypsin levels are much lower. And because of that, you have increased digestion of different tissues, particularly the lung, and this leads to development of lung emphysema and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So the lung phenotype is actually the number one cause of death, and because you lack the protein, then it's the most kind of easy way to kind of take care of that is to substitute this protein. And this is what the alpha-1 antitrypsin augmentation does. So patients who have some kind of lung damage may get a weekly infusion of this purified human plasma protein. So it's like you can purify albumin from the human plasma, you can also purify alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, and this is a widely used therapy for the lung disease. But then again, the lung and liver are two different organs with two different mechanisms. So the question was quite obvious. This treatment, which in Germany is really given, let's say, to 50% of patients with the severe alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, because you often find them because of their lung disease, then the question and the hypothesis or the rationale of the article was to figure out whether this has any effect on the liver.
Oh, great. Thanks a lot for some insight onto the background for this article. Now, can I just ask, how common is this disease? And do all patients with this disease, will they always have hepatic manifestations?
What we are now talking about is the classic severe genotype, which is called ZZ. That's a homozygous Z mutation. This one is found primarily on, in Caucasians, and in the Caucasians, you have about 1 to 3,000 having this homozygous mutation. You have much more of them having a heterozygous mutation, which is also called MZ. And the MZ in Germany might be 1 to 30 or 1 to 40, but the people receiving the augmentation therapy are the ones with the severe alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. That means the ZZ genotype.
And previously, for those who have received alpha-1 antitrypsin augmentation, has there been any studies showcasing its effects on the liver, or do we have any information on how is safety, liver safety in these patients?
So there have been some information collected during the clinical trials. So as any drug, the augmentation therapy went through clinical trials that measured kind of whether it actually leads to increased serum alpha-1 antitrypsin levels and so on. And as a part of that, there was some basic assessment of liver toxicity as kind of every clinical trial has, but it was not done in detail. And also this was before the time where we had methods that allow non-invasive assessment of liver fibrosis. So there were some relatively rudimental data, and we kind of wanted to dig deeper into that for one reason, to actually check the safety, but also given that alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is now a disease where there is a lot of research going on, and there are different therapeutic approaches that may help, for example, the liver but not the lung. And these approaches then need to be actually combined with potential augmentation. So we kind of wanted to set the stage and to make sure that we know as much as we can about the safety of this drug.
Great. So maybe you can walk us through your study. How was this study actually designed, and in terms of was it retrospective, prospective, and how do you select the patients for augmentation?
So this is basically, this study emerged from a long-term, and that is basically a systematic collection of the data from these patients. So Aachen is leading a large European multi-center registry where we try to kind of document the lung and liver status of all patients we see. And this over years led to a few hundreds of these patients, and which we initially actually used for things like analyzing the extent of liver fibrosis and so on. So basically we took these data which were existing and asked this specific question whether the augmentation therapy that was collected, or the information about the augmentation therapy was collected for every patient. And we used it to actually find out whether these people change in some way. Also, as a part of this registry, we collected liver biopsies. So we also were able to look in the livers whether patients with and without augmentation therapy have any difference in their histologic phenotype. So that's kind of how it came around.
Was there any information on the reason for the liver biopsies, or they were only done if they were clinically indicated?
These were done on a kind of discretion of the physician, and It was usually because of the typical things like repeated elevated liver enzymes or liver stiffness indicative of significant liver fibrosis for basic liver fibrosis grading or staging for exactly. So we didn't do any biopsy kind of for the study purposes on its own.
Great. So I think that kind of moves us forward to discuss the significant results of the study. Perhaps Professor Pavel, you could share with us what do you think are some of the most important findings that this study has revealed?
So I think first of all, and the most important finding is that it provides a clear message that this treatment is liver safe. So that's I think the most important thing, which again for a therapy that's widely used and for patients who actually have significant kind of liver disease predisposition is an important message. The second part is let's say in terms of significance, a little bit weaker. So we had some data suggesting that these patients may actually have slightly better livers. And again, so the problem with this observation study is always that you cannot say what is an association, what is a causal effect. But that's kind of how we clinicians work. And of course, the best way to resolve these things would be to perform a randomized prospective trial. But this is in terms of kind of money you need for that without our reach. But I think even at this stage, it clearly shows you that augmentation is safe and that it might be beneficial rather than detrimental for the liver.
So I guess it's kind of the study actually provides some interesting data, I would say, to kind of base help us to base further research on augmentation therapy in the liver. Can I also ask for this study, do we have any information on how long these patients were on, or is there any median duration for which the patients were on augmentation therapy? So that was the first thing. And the second thing I was kind of curious about is how about the duration of follow-up for these patients? How do we know that these patients have had the therapy for a good period of time and they have been followed up for a good period of time? Because I think we need those information to establish safety as well.
So it was a cross-sectional study, so we didn't do follow-up. It was basically everybody was asked once. During this cross-sectional study, we did collect the information on how long the augmentation therapy is being given, and there have been patients who had it 10 or even more years, and kind of there was a trend towards better liver values in the patients who had it for a longer time. So at the very least, again, even we can say that even patients who reportedly had it for many, many years don't seem to have any signs of advanced liver injury. So on one hand, we looked at the classic liver enzymes. We looked also at the well-known biomarkers that are like non-invasive biomarkers of liver fibrosis, such as APRI or FIB-4. And all patients also have had liver stiffness measurement performed by transient elastography. So it was, let's say, quite reasonably done with the state-of-the-art screening techniques for liver function on one hand, and it was based on the basically patient history data for the duration of the augmentation therapy.
I see. And I think in the study, part of your data actually showed that there was a significant difference in AST but not ALT for the liver enzymes. So that I found was quite interesting. Will you be able to kind of expound on that, or suggest a reason why this might be more common in those patients on augmentation therapy?
So at the beginning, there were several, let's say, hypotheses why alpha-1 antitrypsin augmentation might be beneficial. So one of them is that there are some experimental data suggesting that there is a feedback loop, the way we know it, from endocrinology. That means that if you put something into the system, the body doesn't need to produce that much. So that was kind of one hypothesis, so that you would actually kind of decrease the hepatic production because the body would feel like we have enough of alpha-1 antitrypsin. This we were not able to confirm because at least in the limited amount of biopsies, we had a similar amount of accumulation in the liver, so we did not see an effect on AAT hepatic accumulation. But what we did see is signals for some kind of potential anti-inflammatory function. And it's known that actually the alpha-1 antitrypsin is an anti-inflammatory molecule because it's a broad protease inhibitor, and some of these proteases are actually pushing inflammatory reactions, and there might be also protease-independent factors. So there are several data suggesting that that the augmentation might be mildly protective, and out of the potential mechanisms underlying this effect, we believe that an anti-inflammatory function might be is the most likely one, and at least this is supported by the fact that the liver histologies from the augmented patients had less inflammatory foci than the histologies from the patients without augmentation.
Yeah, so that's a really great kind of insight into why augmentation therapy actually works for the liver. And certainly we hope that this is one of possibly a novel emerging therapy for alpha-1 antitrypsin-related liver disease. Moving forward, just beyond alpha-1 augmentation therapy, alpha-1 antitrypsin augmentation therapy. You mentioned earlier in our discussion that there are other emerging therapies for alpha-1 antitrypsin-related liver disease. Could you give us a brief, maybe kind of summary of some of these potential therapies and how could they possibly work together with augmentation therapy to help these patients?
So, as we mentioned already, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency associated liver disease is basically gain of function phenotype. That means that you have too much misfolded protein in the liver. So, there are basically two major ways to kind of change it. The most obvious one is actually to stop the production of the alpha-1 antitrypsin in the liver. So, this is actually the only approach that has first significant human data. There was a phase two study published last year in New England Journal of Medicine, where we could show that if you block the production of alpha-1 antitrypsin with an siRNA, that means with a molecule that blocks the production on an RNA level, that you on one hand increase the serum alpha-1 antitrypsin levels, but you also decrease the accumulation in the liver. And this decreased accumulation was also associated with normalization of liver function tests like ALT, AST, gamma GT, and so on. So that's basically the one approach that exists and that has positive human data. There are other approaches entering early phase clinical trials, like a CRISPR-Cas-based kind of DNA editing approach. There are some completely new strategies like RNA-based editing, which would mean that you actually on RNA level switch the mutated mRNA back to the wild type mRNA. This is probably the most exciting approach for the years to come, and this is something where the alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency place really a pioneering work for similar diseases. And in addition to this kind of approach to somehow decrease the levels, there is another approach which is on a protein level, and that's basically a chaperone-based based approach. So using small molecules to improve the folding and to improve the secretion. So the approach is that decrease the production of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency have, let's say, at least a theoretical chance to actually increase the lung phenotype, because you would have even less of the protective protein. So that's why, at least at these stages, it's used only with patients with well-preserved lung function, just for abundance of caution. And down the road, it may be combined with the augmentation therapy. In comparison to that, the advantage or the hope for the chaperone-based approaches is that actually it's a magic bullet that it will do both. So that it would decrease the amount of the misfolded protein in the liver and bring the ideally functional active protein into the bloodstream to protect the lung as well. So that would be the magic bullet serving both organs. The RNA base editing would be also a magic bullet serving both organs, but none of these kind of big dream approaches have positive human data yet. So there is a lot to watch for, and but there is still also quite a bit of work to be done.
Indeed, and I guess we look forward to your research and your team's research in this space. So before we kind of end off, Professor Pavel, thank you so much for taking the time to share your expertise on this very rare liver disease with us. Do you have any last comments or anything that you want to say to our listeners about alpha-1 antitrypsin-related liver disease?
I think especially for the younger listeners, I think what was done in this rare disease shows how big potential is there even looking for rarer diseases. Otherwise, everybody, you know, works on cirrhosis, and there are tons of good researchers. And also how important it is to network and to you know, come together and to make consortia, especially in the case of rare diseases. And I think in this space, networking is the key, and shows that if you do that, then even a rare disease can get very exciting. And sometimes a rare disease might be the more approachable target than the complicated multifactorial disorders like NASH or MAFLD or whatever you want to call them, because in this case this is a monogenic disorder, so you actually kind of quite well understand where it all starts, and this is much easier, and also is potentially interesting to bring completely new therapeutic approaches that are much more difficult in complex diseases.
And with that, thank you very much. And thank you to our listeners for listening to this latest podcast by the Liver Foundation. We hope to see you the next time as well. Thank you, Professor Pavel.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
We have come to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us, and stay tuned for more captivating discussions.